Conversations with God is a book that was first published in 1995 and lived on the New York Times bestseller list for 137 weeks. Neil Donald Walsh, the author, was shocked. But the book's popularity was not what kept those conversations alive. Desire for the divine and truth are perhaps our universal hub. Neil is here sharing his experiences that originally became known in 1995 and today, most recently, in his latest book, God Talk. I'm Robin, your host for Tributaries. So, congratulations on your millionth book.
Well, that's sweet of you to say. Thank you very much. I'm just grateful that I've been given something to share and that I've had the opportunity to share with some other people. Not everyone has that opportunity, so I've been given that opportunity by life, and I'm very grateful.
I saw a video when you were asked how you got started on your spiritual journey, and you said you were born, and I liked that. I had a chuckle, and I thought, simple and to the point, which I believe the same can be said for truth.
Yes, I think that would be my understanding as well. Yes.
So you've written about 40 books. I don't know if it's 40 dead on, and Conversations with God perhaps being the most well known. What transpired for you, Neil, to write this latest book, God Talk, and who was it written for?
Well, you know, ordinarily an author, whatever their main topic is, will write a book and then seek a publisher, see if they can find someone who wants to put the book out. And that's been my experience as well for my first 39 books. But in this instance, my telephone rang and it was a publisher calling me. That had never happened before in all of my years. This publisher said, would you be willing to write a book telling people how you move through the process of having your own conversations with God and how they might also involve themselves in talking to God? We could call the book God Talk. And I said, you know, I'd be happy to write that book. So I sat down and wrote out a little book on that topic, sharing with people the process that I have used. Then the publisher had a really interesting idea. So they put a notice on the internet saying to the general public, if you have ever felt that God intervened in your life directly, please send us your story. And they could receive hundreds of stories from people all over the world, as you might imagine.
Yes.
And so they included some of the best of those stories in this particular book because they wanted to make the point that, hey, look, Neil is not the only person who's having conversations with God. They included those stories in the book, and that's the answer to your question. Why did I happen to write this book? Because I was asked to.
I would imagine the other books that you've written, you weren't given a phone call direct from the phone company, but there was another type of asking.
Yes, that's a very nice way of putting it, actually, Robin. I did feel an urging from inside of myself, a yearning and an urging and an invitation, if you please, to bring forward messages that I was given. And so I allowed myself to do that. It started off as a very personal experience that I was having. I didn't sit down to write a book. I was having a personal encounter with my understanding of the divine. But in that first encounter, I was actually told, you will make of this one day a book, and it will be accessed by many people. And you know, Robin, I thought to myself, okay, now I gotcha. Because I thought, there's nobody in the world going to publish a book because a guy says he's talking to God. And even if somebody was silly enough to publish such a book, no one's going to read it. It was such an outlandish idea that I thought, okay, I will send my handwritten notes to a publisher just on a, frankly, on a dare, daring God to make it real. Well, you know, a publisher on the East Coast, not a major publisher, it wasn't like Putnam or Random House, but an independent small publisher on the East Coast to whom I sent my notes called me And they said, we'd like to publish your book. I thought, you're kidding. They said, no, we'd love to publish it. We find it very interesting. So they put the book out. And I thought, you know, this is not going to sell 500 copies. Nobody's going to buy a book because a guy claims to be talking to God. You know, it's just not going to happen. And I was right. It didn't sell 500 copies. It sold 5 million.
Right.
I was shocked. I was blown out of the water in a sense. I just didn't know where to go with that information. What? 5 million copies? Ultimately translated into 37 languages. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yes, well, it's a good story so far, so I don't blame you at all. And you write about the importance of knowing the true nature of God. And I'm wondering how you think giving a new definition of God will change things when it seems God is beyond definition.
That's a very good question. Thank you. I'm stuttering to find a way to answer it smoothly. How I think it could change things is in the following way. First of all, let's set the stage. The surveys have shown that sociologists have taken surveys over the past 10 years in all of the major countries of the world. And it was a simple one-question survey, a single question. Do you believe in a higher power? And 8 out of 10 people, actually statistically 85% of the respondents said yes. So we discovered then that a large majority of the people on the planet believe in a higher power. And those people have been members of or become members of one of the world's religions. People don't know this generally, but there are over 4,000 religions on the face of the earth. Not, I don't mean since the time began. I mean, right now, being practiced on the earth today, 4,223 separate faith traditions now being practiced. Now, here's to get to the heart of your question. Those faith traditions teach us, at least the largest number of them, teach us that God is a loving deity, but also a judgmental, condemning, and punishing deity. In other words, we do what God wants us to do and what God apparently needs us to do, or God will punish us with everlasting damnation. The second thing those religions teach us or invite us to do is to act according to the divine. In other words, to imitate the divine. We are invited to use God's behavior as a model for our own interactions with each other. Therefore, humanity has found it understandable and justifiable to be judgmental, condemning, and punishing of each other. So we have followed the religious tradition of modeling divine behavior because we've assumed that divine behavior is to judge, condemn, and punish each other. Now you ask the question, what would redefining God do to change that situation on the planet? If we decided that God was misunderstood, that we really are best served by redefining the nature of the divine. And if we decided that God could be really defined in two words, pure love, if we thought that was really the nature of the divine, and if we concluded, therefore, that God is not, in fact, judgmental, condemning, or punishing, we would lose our justification. We would lose our foundation for acting the way we act with each other when we disagree with each other or when another person does not do what we demand that they do. So it could change everything on our planet if we simply decided two things, that we are also pure love, because that each of us is an individual expression of the only thing there is, which I call God or the so-called higher power. You see, Robin, if I could just conclude my little diatribe here. You asked me a 30-second question. I'm going to give you a 12-minute answer. But to conclude my little diatribe, we have understood God to be separate from us, something other than us, who therefore commands us and loves us for sure. Religions teach us that God loves us, but judges us, as I said before, if we don't do what God commands. And that could get down to something as simple as, what we eat or what we wear. Certain religions teach that we have to wear certain clothing, especially if we're female. We may not show any part of our body, and we have to cover our face. And this is a commandment from God. As a child, I was born and raised as a Roman Catholic. I was told we could not eat meat on Fridays. We had to have meatless Fridays. This was God's desire. I was told many other things as well. Let me share one thing that I'll never forget that I was told, Robin. I was in a Catholic school, Catholic elementary school, and the priest came into our classroom once a week to teach us catechism, the doctrines and the dogmas of the Catholic Church. This particular week, he was sharing about the difference between mortal sin and venial sin, which is a kind of a spiritual misdemeanor, and a mortal sin. That is, if you died with that sin on your soul, you would go straight to hell. No questions asked. No questions asked. Now, I'm 9 years old, Robin. I'm raising my nine-year-old hand, and I'm saying in the classroom, Father, could you give us an example of what is a mortal sin? I was sure he would say, well, murder or stealing someone's life savings. He said, sure, I can give you an example. A mortal sin, if you miss Mass on Sunday without a good excuse, and you will go straight to hell if you die with that sin on your soul. My nine-year-old mind is trying to grasp that God would send me to everlasting damnation because I didn't go to church on Sunday. Talk about filling the pews with fear.
Right, making people be in fear and or shame by suggesting and mandating with things like that and the Ten Commandments, or making our need to be better humans. And to me, that's like treating symptoms when we need to get to the source.
I couldn't agree with you more. I have written in the book titled The God Solution that what we do need to do is finally redefine God and to declare that God is, in fact, pure love. Now, when I make that kind of a statement in front of an audience, somebody inevitably gets up in the back of the room and says, oh, Mr. Walsh, come on. And we came here and we've heard you talk now for 20 minutes. Your big revelation is that God is love. Everyone knows that God is love. Even the religions who differ on dogma agree that God is love. And I have to say to my friend in the back of the room, whoa, wait a minute. That's not what I said. I didn't say God is love. I said God is pure love.
Well, it comes down
now my
to
friend,
definition.
Now my friend in the back of the room will say, okay, what's the difference? And I have to explain, pure love needs, expects, requires, and demands nothing in return. If we love another person and we are expecting something in return for the love we are giving to that other person, we've turned love into a transaction.
So in my book, that isn't even love. It definitely isn't pure love, but it isn't love either. You know, God or spirit is always seeking an outlet and having us be an outlet. So everyone has the capacity, and yet not all of us have a conscious seeking. And I'm wondering if you think our desires for worldly things are our own personal vehicles to eventually get us there.
I'm not sure that our desires for worldly things are those vehicles, but I think our desires for worldly experiences are those vehicles. I want to say that the soul's agenda is not simply to know who we are, but to find ourselves in a position to literally place ourselves in a position to demonstrate, to express, thus to be able to experience who we really are, to be understanding, or to be patient, or to be forgiving, or to be demonstrating any aspect of divinity at all, and to use my daily life as opportunities to do exactly that. My dear Robin, when I made that decision that that's what my life was all about, sadly, I didn't get to that clarity until I was 53 years old. But when I came to that decision, everything changed. My experience of myself changed dramatically.
What decision was that?
To use every moment of my life as an opportunity to demonstrate who I experience myself as being through doing it, to put beingness into doingness, to not just say what I am, but to do it.
Of course, yes. Yes. Now, you mentioned the word patience right now. I imagine it takes quite a bit of patience to be a spokesperson for God and spirituality. What challenges do you find about that, or do you?
Yes, I'm running out of patience with you immediately.
I thought you might.
No, I'm just having fun. But of course, I run into challenges all the time. And I have to allow myself to notice that life was designed to bring me those opportunities, to bring me those challenges. We live in a contextual field. And in our contextual field, that which we are not arises in our experience in order that we might demonstrate that which we are.
Of course, yeah.
Because in the absence, Robin, of what we are not, what we are cannot be experienced. For instance, in the absence of tall, short cannot be experienced. In the absence of slow, fast cannot be experienced. In the absence, to be dramatic, of the darkness, being the light cannot be experienced. So raise not your fist to heaven, and curse the darkness not, but be a light unto the darkness, that you might know who you really are. Or as someone far wiser than I will ever be said a few thousand years ago, judge not and neither condemn.
Isn't that a challenge?
It is until it isn't anymore.
Right.
It is until it becomes less and less of a challenge and more of an opportunity. And
of
the
course.
Joy that fills the human heart when we experience ourselves in those wondrous ways.
It may have been through all of the ages, of course, I don't know, but there's certainly an epidemic of urgency, creating so much suffering for people by feeling this urgency. Do you experience this, and what is your guidance for people when they're caught up in so much urgency? I just feel like there is a...
I feel the importance of the times, and I do feel the urgency of the opportunity that we are all given to announce and to declare, to express and to fulfill our true identity, and to recognize, that is to recognize, that is to know again, to recognize who everyone else is. That when we see everyone else in our life, friends, neighbors, family members, even, if you please, people we would once have called enemies, when we see every other person that populates our life in their true identity and see who they really are, then everything changes. And there's an urgency for us to do that, because right now we're not doing that. There's war all over the planet. Here we go again. It simply doesn't stop. We haven't learned how to stop killing each other. I mean, by the thousands, when we have a disagreement over something like a borderline between the two countries. I mean, really? I mean, honestly, we can't agree on where to draw the border between our countries, so we're going to kill around 25,000 people to make the point? I mean, is there no other way for us to resolve our differences? Do our contrasts have to create conflicts? Is this who we really are? Such a species, primitive species.
Yes.
So is there an urgency? Yes, I think there's an urgency, because the process of our evolution as a civilization is moving, in my view, entirely too slowly. And if we're not careful, we could really end life as we know it on this planet. We're only a few steps away from that. Global nuclear war could occur. At the drop of a hat.
But how does that fit in? How do you think that affects God? I don't believe it affects that world of the Creator and the Spirit. I just feel
I agree with you. It doesn't affect God in the sense that God wants to do something about it. Because if God wanted to stop that process, he would have no problem doing that. All he would have to do is just insert himself in the situation. But it's not, in my understanding, it's not God's desire to dictate to us how we should or shall behave. It's been God's desire from the beginning to simply produce, not only here, but throughout the cosmos, sentient beings who are given the gift of the ability to create their own reality, engaging in a process that we loosely call evolution. So we are now involved in that process on this planet. And yes, I agree with you. God will not insert herself in such a process because it's not her intention that we should suddenly become minions in his kingdom and we do what he demands or she punishes us. That's not my understanding of ultimate reality.
Yeah.
Nor is it my awareness of what pure love is really all about.
With your book being called God Talk, what do you think about talking to God? God is all-knowing. And for us to start talking to God, isn't it more important to be listening?
I'm not sure that it is.
Okay.
I think that listening and talking are equally important.
Okay.
I think that when we talk to God, we are sharing with the highest power in the universe, of which we are simply an individual expression. It's not like we're talking to something that's separate from us. We're simply talking to a part of ourselves that lives within each sentient being in the cosmos, as I mentioned a moment ago. So, but I think that talking to God is just as important as listening to God, because talking to God sets the agenda for us in a particular moment. What is it that we want God to know that we are most focused on, most concerned about, most yearning for, most desiring, and most wishing to experience? So God says, you know, tell me, talk to me. Come on, talk to me. Tell me what it is that you wish to know about yourself, to experience about yourself, to express through yourself. Tell me. And then I will share with you how you can do that. So I think that talking and listening are equally important, just as it might be true, frankly, in any relationship. If we have any kind of meaningful relationship in our life, relationship with a live-in partner, with a spouse, with a dear family member, if we're not both listening and sharing, then we're only using one aspect of a two-way process called communication.
So in your book, I'll Talk, you said that the publishers brought X amount of people that had a God experience. Would you like to share one of those with us right now?
They're wonderful, wonderful stories. And many, many people have stories of God intervening in their life. It's interesting. God doesn't necessarily just, you know, show up as a voice out of the sky or a bolt of lightning or something. God shows up and intervenes in our life in 100 different ways across 1,000 different moments in 1,000,000 lifetimes. But one of the interesting stories of how God does that is that there's a story of a lady who got an answer on what she should do next to solve a health problem that she was experiencing. And she got an answer from her 6-year-old child. And the mommy realized, wow, if that isn't God intervening and using my own 6-year-old daughter to tell me, you know, she gave her, with the innocence of a 6-year-old, and gave her such pure, clean advice that the mother's decision on how to behave in the weeks ahead was dramatically changed. And she actually healed herself. And the whole point made by the book is that God does not just talk to us like whispering in our ear. That's one way that you can receive information from the divine. But there are, as I said, hundreds of different ways that God talks to us.
Yeah, well, I hope our interview today can inspire everyone to take a moment and reflect, perhaps, or just remember a time in their life when that sort of thing happened.
And to stay awake, to really notice, because people are having conversations with God all the time. They're simply calling it something else.
Right.
Indeed. Coincidence or serendipity or, you know, women's intuition, whatever they want to call it. We are all receiving information from the divine, in my experience and in my observation, all the time. So the question is, are we really paying attention to it? So wakefulness is one of the steps that I use and that I share with people. If you want to have your own conversation with God, you have to step into the possibility. You have to embrace your worthiness to do so. You have to step into your willingness to have such an experience. And then you must embrace wakefulness. Stay awake. Don't let it go in one ear and out the other.
Yeah.
Then step number five, acceptance. I want you to accept what you've heard and not toss it aside and say, ah, it's just my imagination. By the way, I did ask God about that. I said, how do I know this is not just my imagination? God says, you know what she answered me? He said, it is. What makes you think I wouldn't use your imagination as one of the many tools that I would use to communicate with you? Where do you suppose Mozart's music came from? Where did Michelangelo's beautiful images in the Sistine Chapel come from? Use your imagination as well. And so the sixth step is discernment. To discern the difference between messages from the divine and messages that come to us from all the other sources in the universe, including these days, the internet. So we have an opportunity to really engage in God talk.
Thank you to Neil Donald Walsh, author of God Talk. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. You can listen there or find our podcasts wherever your favorite podcasts are. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.